Hey everyone, welcome back to That Jesus Podcast. We are a day late and a dollar short as per usual, but we are back. I think our schedule is every week when it works and not more than every other week, which is to say, if you don't hear from us at least every other week, every fortnight, then you should send help. I'm here again with Lissel, and we're going to be looking at the rest of the story of Gideon tonight. But how is life for you? That's a really weird question to ask your wife.
No, you should tell them how my life is right now.
She has a cold.
Yeah, I have a cold.
You didn't go to church this morning.
No, I did not.
So that's how life is going. But you're also happy because spring has sprung, the grass has riz.
Mm-hmm. That's right.
And we have birdies all over our lawn, so we don't have to worry about where the birdies is.
What?
Don't you know that poem?
No.
Spring has sprung, the grass has riz, I wonder where the birdies is.
No, it makes me think of the one about, I'm so glad that cows don't fly. That's all I can think of, and I'm pretty sure it's not.
Wait,
the
how
same.
Does that one end?
You sure you want to know that right now?
Well, I can always edit it out.
Okay. It goes like, a birdie in the sky drop some whitewash in my eye. Me no care, me no cry. I'm just glad that cows don't fly.
Oh, profound. Very profound.
You didn't know that before?
I don't think I've heard that one before.
Good grief. You were a sheltered homeschooler.
So I just finished the spiritual memoir, spiritual autobiography of Ginger Volo Duggar.
Oh, do you have that on audio?
Yeah, I do. It's on Scribd, and I'm going to put a link into it for our podcast.
Because I would like to listen to that.
Yeah, it was really, really interesting. There was this like specter of John MacArthur behind everything she said, which is probably says more about me and my frustrations with John MacArthur. But it was really interesting to hear her process. And she hates deconstruction. She thinks that deconstruction is bad and people shouldn't deconstruct. They should disentangle.
Well, basically what she's saying is that she didn't want to lose her curiosity about who Jesus was to her. And so much of, what's that word?
Disentangling or deconstruction?
Deconstruction has been about, happens when people have lost their curiosity about who Jesus is to them personally. Or that's where it goes. And when you reach that point, then you're in danger zone. And that's, she was not interested in being part of that.
Yeah. I feel like she probably was making much ado about minor semantical differences.
But think about it. If all of her friends were saying, I'm deconstructing, and they walked away from Jesus, like, you can see why she's going to be cautious about using that language. I mean, you and I both have language we're really cautious about because of what we went through.
Yeah. Yeah, for sure. And anyhow, I really appreciate it. It'd be really fun to get her on the podcast, but I think she's way far out of our price range. She had a lot of insight and a lot of really good processing of Bill Gothard and the teaching that she was absolutely immersed from very young, which I am deeply familiar with as well. But yeah, what have you been reading lately?
I haven't been reading. I told the children that. Oh, what did they do? Oh, they listened to Narnia this summer, like straight.
Like
summer.
17 times?
No, I mean, not. Okay, so maybe they were listening and reading it privately 17 times, but over through the audiobook.
Yeah.
It was just once through like the whole, and we didn't actually do it in order. And I knew Narnia. I think as a kid, we listened to the books on audiobook. So I knew the stories, but it was really cool to be able to hear them again. And then I told them, I don't remember why, but I said, okay, so what is Hobbit actually about? What is The Hobbit? And the kids have read The Hobbit, and some of them have been through The Lord of the Rings. Mm-hmm. And so I was like, okay, listen to The Hobbit out loud, and I want to hear it. So we're working on that right now. So far, it is actually pretty dismal. I mean, I remember watching. Remember I watched Hobbit with you and I said no.
Part of it, yeah.
I said no, that is not. I'm not sure if I even want that kind of stuff in the house.
Yep.
And honestly, I don't know if I still don't know what I think about it, but it's been long enough I don't really remember much. But I do remember watching the movie and saying, this is dismal. Like, there's a lot of, like, they start with this really happy, wealthy, wonderful time in the Hobbit hole, and they get to show his life. And then all of a sudden, there's a lot of dark, scary stuff in the story.
Yeah.
And realizing it actually is that way in the book, too.
Yeah. And, yeah. So, do you feel like there are any cool parts or redemptive parts about the Hobbit story, or not yet?
I mean, I'm not finished yet. I don't really know.
Yeah.
So,
yeah. They do get the dragon. Spoiler alert.
I remember that from the movie.
Yeah, but the movie and the book aren't the same. Yeah. Anything stand out to you from your walk through Narnia? Like the whole seven books? Like what's your favorite moment?
Oh, I really love Narnia a lot. I actually didn't really know the story of the last battle real well. But so I think the beaver says it first. He's like way back at the beginning. He's like, he's not exactly a tame lion. And that is kind of a theme when you're going through, is that he's not exactly a tame lion. And when we get to the last battle, the thing is, he's not exactly a tame lion. And that gets twisted and used to the advantage of the enemy. And it's truth, but the enemy twisted it.
Yeah.
And the thing that I thought about a lot this time is that that happens today. I mean, the heresies that sell the best and are worst are those that are laced with truth.
Or even mostly true.
Yeah. Yeah.
Which brings us back to Bill Gothard.
I know. Exactly.
Yeah. Yeah, well, we are looking at the rest of the story of Gideon here. And we all know the first half of the story of Gideon. But there is a lot that happens after he gets his primary victory over the Midianites. They move in and they have to kind of pick up the dregs. And where we left off last time, like 2 or 3 weeks ago, we were like halfway through the book of Judges, or halfway through chapter 7 of the book of Judges. They blew their 300 ram's horns and the whole army turned against each other because the Lord caused that to happen. He caused the chaos. And the rest of the story is basically going to take us through the cleanup operation, the mop up, and what happens to Gideon after that. So are you ready to jump into that?
Sure.
Okay. So, Judges chapter 7, verse 24. They pursue the Midianites, and so they're chasing after them, and I think Gideon must be like, wow, I'm tired of running. He sent messengers throughout the hill country of Ephraim with this message: come down to intercept the Midianites and take control of the watercourses ahead of them as far as Beth Barah and the Jordan. So all the men of Ephraim were called out, and they took control of the watercourses as far as Beth Barah and the Jordan. They captured Oreb and Zeb, and they brought their heads back to them. And that brings us to chapter 8. But the Ephraimites, who were part of Gideon's like larger community of God's chosen people, were a little bit ticked off. Chapter 8, verse 1, the men of Ephraim said to Gideon, "Why have you done this to us, not calling us when you went to fight against the Midianites?" And they argued with him violently. So what kind of stands out to me here right away is how any great victory will always be undone by infighting. And you really see this happening, at least the Ephraimites trying to start infighting, enough to like say they were arguing violently. They wanted a piece of the pie. They wanted to be recognized as the big guys. And Gideon's response is really interesting. "What have I done now compared to you?" he says. "Is not the gleaning of Ephraim better than the grape harvest of Ebiezer? God has handed over to you Oreb and Zeb, the two princes of Midian. What was I able to do compared to you?" When he said this, their anger against him subsided.
You almost get the impression that they're not realizing that this was God's work. They weren't there to see how the Midianites turned on each other. And so in their mind, Gideon is doing this great work without them. And Gideon's like, actually, God is doing this work. You did more than I did, really.
Yeah, which is super gracious of him. He does say, God handed over to you Oreb and Zeb. What was I able to do compared to this? I think this is a good thing that he did. I don't know if there's something here I'm missing, but it definitely feels like there's wisdom being displayed here. You know, a soft answer turns away wrath.
Yeah.
And he really did that.
Yeah.
And he brought it back, like you said, brought it back to God and saying, hey, God gave this to you. and I don't have a lot to boast in. So from there, they continue on, and it says they were exhausted, but still in pursuit. God brought the victory. God won, but they still had work to do, and they were exhausted, but still in pursuit. I definitely relate to that feeling. So he says to the men of Succoth, please give some loaves of bread to the troops under my command, because they're exhausted, for I am pursuing Zeba and Zalmunna, the kings of Midian. But the princes of Succoth said, we want receipts.
Who are these princes of Succoth? Are they Israelites? Are they just other people living in the promised land who had not been kicked out? Who are these people? Are we talking about Israelites who are not willing to give their brothers food? Who are these people?
Yeah, that's a really interesting question. Before I talk about that, I want to just note, they were expecting to attack. So it's only natural that they wouldn't have the supplies they needed for a long journey, you know. It's not like this was their fault that they didn't have what they needed just to survive.
Yeah.
And so Succoth was the tribal portion of Gad on the eastern edge of the Jordan River. This is where Jacob met God, and there was a tower there, so it was an important place. I guess I'm not totally sure if it was...
What are tribal people? Are they talking about the
it was part of Gad. It was part of the tribe of Gad. That's my understanding.
Okay.
But it's on the eastern edge, so
kind of far out on the...
Yeah, this is before they had a king. Their identity as a nation was still being established. And I guess, you know, based on the response in the previous verses from Ephraim and what you see here, although they're supposedly the 12 tribes of Israel, they definitely aren't really united together.
Like, they should still... I mean, we're only into chapter 8. It hadn't been that many years ago that they all got there. I mean, it was enough to talk to their grandparents anyway, right?
No, their grandparents would have died out by now.
So how many years had they been in the promised land by the time we get to Gideon?
Man, now you're putting me on the spot. But I think we're looking at least 3 or 4 generations, because it talked about at the beginning of this journey we took through Judges going back months now, it talked about how they remembered the stories of what God did to give them the land from their parents and grandparents. But then it was like the great grandchildren would have.
So it's like we're related, but no, we're not. We hardly actually, like that's back in our past and that's not.
Yeah, there was tribalism. They weren't willing to help. They were obviously being persecuted by Midian as well. And so this was a good thing for them, but they're not willing to help. It's quite the contrast to like what Jesus said, you know, he who isn't against us is for us. Obviously, Gideon was helping the whole 12 tribes, but they didn't want to participate because they're like, well, we don't actually see these kings in your hand, so we're not going to help you out.
Yeah. Well, and the other thing is they also have this fear that they're just going to, like, how do they know that this is actually a successful mission and isn't going to fall back on them getting more persecution?
Yeah, that's an interesting thought, too. But this is really basically hospitality. Now, hospitality to a whole army, you know, 300 men, that's a lot. But you're talking to the princes of the town there, and there was a tower there. They should have been able to help. So. Yeah. They don't offer hospitality to their own people when they're in desperate need of it. Gideon is not very peaceable in his response. Very well. When the Lord has handed Zeba and Zalmunna over to me, I will tear your flesh with thorns and briars from the wilderness. And the men of Penuel then answer in the same way. And he says, when I return safely, I will tear down this tower.
They're basically doing some civil war threats there.
Yeah. He finally gets them. Jumping down to verse 12. They flee, and he pursues them. He captures the two kings and routs the entire army. Gideon, son of Joash, returned from battle by the ascent of Harris. He captured a youth from the men of Succoth and interrogated him. So he's going back. The youth wrote down for him the names of the 77 leaders and elders of Succoth. 77 of them. So that's a lot. So he goes back to the men of Succoth and says, here they are. And he takes the elders of the city, he took some thorns and briars from the wilderness, and he disciplined the men of Succoth with them.
That is so barbaric.
Yeah, yeah. And we'll see more and more barbarism as we go through the book of Judges. But so I would rather, frankly, have my flesh torn with thorns and briars than be killed. But that's what happens, verse 17 of chapter 8, with the Tower of Penuel. He tears it down and he kills the men of the city.
Well, the whole disciplining with briars, we're not sure how well they lived through that anyway. I mean, seriously.
No idea. Yeah. Yeah, so this is kind of the first time where I really feel like Gideon is, I don't know, I'm not going to say.
He's hangry.
He's hangry. Yeah. He must have gotten something to eat by now. I don't know.
I don't know.
But yeah, he is really ticked with these guys. And his being ticked continues with the kings he captured. So he captures these guys, brings them back alive, and says, here they are. It's not going to end well for them. He asks Zeba and Zalmunna, what kind of men did you kill? They were like you, they said. Each resembled the son of a king. Is it just me, or does that kind of sound like flattery?
Like, okay, so basically they're trying, they resembled the son of a king. Wouldn't they rather try to say they were just some nobodies if they're trying to get out of it?
I don't know, but one way or the other, it didn't work out for them. Gideon's like, and again, maybe he was still hangry at this point. They were my brothers, the sons of my mother, as the Lord lives. If you had let them live, I would not kill you. Then he said to Jether, his firstborn, get up and kill them. The youth did not draw his sword, for he was afraid because he was still a youth. Zeba and Zalmunna then put their foot in their mouth and say, get up and strike us down yourself, for a man is judged by his strength. So Gideon got up, killed Zeba and Zalmunna, and took the crescent ornaments that were on the necks of their animals. Camels.
Did you say they put their foot in their mouth?
I just, like, if I am at the Gideon's mercy, I'm trying to do everything I can to appease and keep him from killing me. And Zeba and Zalmunna are like, are you man enough? Are you going to kill us? Like, seriously, are you strong enough? Do you have what it takes to kill us? That doesn't sound like a good way to win friends and influence people.
Oh, I think that they were snotty little or big men who knew that they were at the end of the rope and they're going to get their last lick in.
Their last dig in.
Yep.
That might be the case too. Yeah, and that's the end of the battle. He kind of ends with a whimper, not a bang. He ends up attacking some of his own people there with Succoth and what was the other name? Penuel.
Yeah.
And then he kills the last two kings. So what's your like big picture take from his victories at this point?
I think he was thorough in what, like, he really, like, he pursued them, he got the kings, all that. And I think that the way he deals with people, he had a sense of justice.
Yeah.
And he would, yeah, wasn't scared to use it.
I think it's interesting that, you know, Gideon did seem very timid, and by his own admission, he was, you know, afraid. And God met him there. And then by the end, it's almost like God said, I'm going to give you the victory. And then you have the responsibility to kind of clean up. Mm-hmm. As if God wants to make sure everybody knows that God is the one who did this. But God still gives Gideon the freedom to make some decisions and to keep fighting, you know, be exhausted and keep pushing on. And not to extrapolate too far, to be too metaphorical or allegorical here, but you know, it often feels that way. Like, we know that Christ has won the victory, but there's still a lot more work to be done. And there are a lot of different ways of finishing the fight. But
it's like he gained a sense of confidence somewhere along the line.
I'm reminded of what, again, this is way out of context, but Paul talking about how he fills up that which is lacking in the sufferings of Christ. And Gideon's kind of, you know, filling in the gap here. As God has given him the victory. Of course, he could never have done what he did without God giving him that initial victory. But yeah, so it's a story of really a man being called for reasons we don't even totally know to pursue God and to pursue what God's calling for him was, and then to keep fighting and keep pushing forward until the last kings are finally struck dead. And that leads us to his legacy. In my Bible, It actually says Gideon's Legacy, and I think that's quite appropriate. This is Judges 8:22. Do you want to read a few verses there?
Then the Israelites said to Gideon, "Rule over us as well as your sons and your grandsons, for you delivered us from the power of Midian." But Gideon said to them, "I will not rule over you, and my son will not rule over you. The Lord will rule over you." Then he said to them, "Let me make a request of you. Everyone give me an earring from his plunder." Now the enemy had gold earrings because they were Ishmaelites. They said, "We agree to give them." So they spread out a cloak, and everyone threw an earring from his plunder on it. The weight of the gold earrings he requested was 43 pounds of gold, in addition to the crescent ornaments and ear pendants, the purple garments on the kings of Midian, and the chains on the necks of their camels. Gideon made an ephod from all this and put it in Ophrah, his hometown. Then all Israel prostituted themselves by worshiping it there, and it became a snare to Gideon and his household.
I wanted to read this last part in particular because a lot of times we don't get this bit in our Bible stories. What he actually does and what Israel does after victory and how he became, I guess he was a judge.
Did he make himself a priest? Is that what the ephod thing is about?
Well, it is kind of a question. It doesn't say he judged Israel for blank many years. At least I didn't see it. And they asked him to be a king. He turns that down. And then he says, "Make me an ephod," which is what a priest would wear, right? So it's like, I don't want to be king. The scripture doesn't call him a judge, although obviously he was fulfilling that role of judge in some ways. And yet this weird thing with, like, he's supposed to be a priest. And of course they worship the ephod there. So yeah, that's kind of my take. And I'm left scratching my head a little bit over what he actually was doing.
I don't think we get to, we don't know that whole story. Like, we're given a glimpse of it. But to actually know the whole story of everything that's going on isn't happening right there.
I think a lot of Bible scholars are scratching their heads too with us. The original ephod of the high priest was not made of gold. It was made of, you know, the costly fabric with gold woven into it, but it had the precious stones. But it wasn't set up as like an idol. They also had the Urim and Thummim that were kind of like tucked inside of it or with the ephod. And that was something that they used to seek God's voice somehow or to make decisions. So there's a lot going on there I don't think we'll ever know. But this is a big, heavy thing, like somewhere between 45 and 70 pounds. And it appears to be able to like stand on its own and to be some sort of idol that would hearken back to the priests. That's kind of my guess.
It's just interesting to me. Like the idol worship, they weren't accused of idol worship until after Gideon died. So I don't understand.
I'm not quite sure I follow that.
Okay, so then it says, when Gideon died, the Israelites turned and prostituted themselves by worshiping the Baals and made Baal-Berith their god.
Yes, see, I was reading a few verses up, and it's kind of interesting to see this connection. Verse 27, he made the ephod, and they prostituted themselves by worshiping it there. And then later he dies, and they turn from worshiping the ephod to worshiping the Baals. And so the ephod was the gateway drug into the very thing that Gideon had delivered the people from.
Yeah, okay, so I missed prostituting word there. It didn't catch me at the moment.
But it's the prostitution, if you will, the spiritual unfaithfulness started with Gideon saying, well, on the one hand, I don't want to be king. I will not rule over you, for the Lord will rule over you. On the other hand, hey, let's make an idol. That's always worked great for us in the past.
Well, it's almost like Gideon didn't. Okay, so they tore down the idol at the beginning, the Asherah thing at the beginning. And then Gideon's dad is like, Baal can stand for himself. But there was never a point at which Gideon actually calls people after the battle to worship God. Instead, it's this ephod thing. And it's like, so why did he pull that down at the beginning? Where was his actual heart? Because it's confusing. Like, power corrupts? What's going on here?
Well, I think there's definitely an element, you know, Gideon had won a pretty big battle. He was just this, you know, boy from the backwoods and became a great general.
He wasn't so a, it, they,
I know. He was a man.
They were very well-to-do. I mean, yeah. Even in the middle of that.
Yeah, we talked about that last time. But no, I think what we see here is a halfway repentance. And this happens multiple times in the Book of Judges, where a person like halfway turns people back to worship God. God works, but it's not complete. And like, this is how they got in the position they did with the book, to start with the Book of Judges, because they did not clean all of the idolatry out of the Promised Land. And that's where, like back in the very beginning of this book, that's where their problems came from, because they had these snares. And so Gideon tears down, deconstructs the Baal and the Asherah, but he doesn't actually fully draw them back to God. Mm-hmm. He doesn't replace it with something. And I'm not trying to be too cute here, but this is something that I did feel like Ginger Duggar said very clearly, is that even as she tore down Bill Gothard and the very false teachings there, she was replacing it with something else. Mm-hmm. And I don't think Gideon did that. The thing he replaced his idolatry with was the gold that he had stolen from Midian, or that he had plundered from Midian, and then turned into an idol. Other times when Israel initially plundered their enemies, they ultimately take that gold and make a tabernacle, but in the process, they also take the gold and make a golden calf. So there's just this process of, we have these things that God has given us. We have this victory over our enemy. What are we going to do? Physically, what are we going to do with the gold? But it's that question, I think we could think more broadly, like, what are we going to do with the quote-unquote gold that we have, with what we've been given, with the time, the resources, as, you know, Americans, with all the blessings we have, what are we going to do with it?
Not like gold, even though, what do we do with the victories we have and the things we've been given?
Mm-hmm.
Like, the experiences we've gone through and the, like, I've wrestled with this, like, the stuff you and I have gone through in our marriage, coming out wiser for it, but, like, now what do we do with it? What was that for, I guess, is the question.
So let me read the last section here. Gideon had 70 sons. Even back in Bible times, that's a lot. Gideon had 70 sons, his own offspring, since he had many wives. His concubine, who was in Shechem, also bore him a son and named him Abimelech. That's called foreshadowing, folks. Then Gideon, son of Joash, died at a good old age and was buried in the tomb of his father Joash in Ophrah of the Abiezrites. Abiezrites. Can't say that one tonight.
I don't know.
When Gideon died, the Israelites turned and prostituted themselves by worshiping the Baals and made Baal Berith their god. They actually had like their own god that they fully vested in and said, yep, this is who we're serving now. The Israelites did not remember the Lord their God, who had rescued them from the hand of the enemies around them. They did not show kindness to the house of Jerubbaal, that is Gideon, for all the good that he had done for Israel. Kind of depressing end to the story. We're left here, and I'm hearkening back to some of what we talked about with our church group a couple weeks ago, just about leadership. And you mentioned this idea of leadership, power corrupting people. They come and ask him to be made, ask him if he wants to become king. And he's like, no. But even though he gives them peace for all those decades, it doesn't actually make a difference. His legacy is basically a net zero, right?
Well, unless you want to call the next chapter a legacy. Okay, that's not true that his legacy is a net zero. That's not entirely true because we still have his story.
Mm-hmm.
So, yes, there's a legacy there. Is he in Hebrews?
Yeah, he is one of the people. Given throwaway mention, you know, I don't have time to talk about Gideon.
Yeah, so, like, there's this... I don't know, I almost wonder if we shouldn't be careful what we say about him. I feel like there's so much that they... Like, his story, the end of his life, is wrapped up in so few verses. Like, I feel like there's stuff we don't know.
Yeah, but even what we do know, again, I don't know how much time it took for Israel to turn to Gideon and say, rule over us. But it was close enough time that they still had all their gold earrings mm-hmm. from the enemies.
Yeah.
So within a very short period of time, there was this pivotal, critical point where Gideon had to make a decision. And by what he did and didn't do, he really undermined, I think, what God would have wanted to do through him. When you're given that power, when you're given that opportunity, how you react is going to set the pace for the rest of your legacy. And of course, he could have turned at any point and said, hey, I'm going to tear down this idol, take two, gotten rid of the ephod. But it seems like he didn't. And their prostitution of worshiping an idol became a snare to Gideon and his whole household. So
it's weird. It's a weird story to me. I wonder if that was the only concubine. How does somebody have that many wives and only one concubine? Usually it's fewer wives and a whole bunch of concubines, isn't it?
Yeah, I don't know.
The word concubine is a terrible word. Like, it just doesn't sound pretty in your mouth. I don't know. Gish.
Yeah, and it's kind of interesting. They put the many wives and a concubine kind of sandwiched between the two mentions of Israel prostituting themselves to idols.
Yeah.
So you almost feel like there's this, like, this spiritual unfaithfulness, and again, bringing my like monogamy New Covenant worldview to this like physical marital lack of faithfulness too. It's kind of tough to wrap up such a broad story, but I think for me personally, Gideon is such a man of faith who God chose to stretch, and he was willing to be stretched. But it's almost like when God stopped actively stretching him and then tested to see what he would do with power and with the opportunity to be a leader, he just totally folded. And it's pretty sobering.
Well, did he lead or did he choose not to lead?
This is the problem. Some of us do not have the choice whether we lead or not. I would say actually probably nobody can just say, oh, I'm not a leader and I'm not going to lead. Somebody is following you. Somebody is paying attention, and you are going to have an impact or influence on somebody's lives. It's not enough to just hide back in the corner and say, oh, no, I don't have any influence on somebody's life. You will, and you can't escape that. And so Gideon just saying, no, I'm not going to rule over you. My son will not rule over you. The Lord will rule over you. Instead of actually saying, what will it look like for me to use this influence that I have for power? He didn't steward it well. I guess I'm rambling a bit here.
Yeah, but okay, so he blew it in the ephod thing. Like that feels like you shouldn't have done that. It was a snare for his family. I don't know what he was trying to do. Like, maybe he was trying to say, look at this ephod, and it will make you think of God. I've heard of idol worship that ends up like that, or starts like that.
Yeah.
But, go ahead.
Yeah, I'm not saying that he just did something horrible, or maybe there wasn't something that he was thinking about with this ephod as being a good thing. You know, maybe it was supposed to be like those stones they erected, you know, at the water when they crossed the Jordan. He's like, let's gather all the plunder and make something that points to God. And it didn't work.
No.
And he should have known better. But my point is to say that each of us, like, are like Gideon, and people are going to say, okay, come have influence, come use your power. We want you to lead us. And if we just pretend that we don't have that influence, if we just pretend that there aren't people looking to us for input, for guidance, for discipleship, for care, for support, for friendship, if we just pretend, oh no, I'm just nobody, and we have this like faux humility about ourselves, we're just blinding ourselves to the reality that we do have influence.
Okay, but isn't there a time to say, I don't want this kind of attention? It seemed like that's what Gideon said. He's like, God will rule over you. It was like he said, I don't want that kind of attention. It wasn't his fault that God called him to do that. God called him to free him from the people from the Midianites. God did not call him to rule over them. And you're kind of saying, yeah, he should have stepped into that role and done that. And I'm wondering, it's like, maybe it wasn't entirely wrong for him to do that. Yes, the ephod thing was foolish. I think my question is if you're somewhere in life and something big happens and all eyes turn on you,
mm-hmm.
But you're not necessarily into having that kind of attention. And you want your space to be human.
Mm-hmm.
Like, what do you do with that? People are people and they tend to follow, but are we responsible for that? I think there's a place for saying, okay, I did the bit that God, I hope there's a place for saying that I did the bit that God called me to do. And I'm stepping back now. And no, I'm not going to be your hero. But.
Yeah.
Yeah, I don't know.
Yeah, but still, like, these are judges. These are men, and there's this pattern. Men and a woman that God appointed to lead and to guide the people to worship God. They weren't kings. And so they did have greatness thrust upon them, and Gideon punted, which I think, to your question, I think it's okay to punt for a season, but if this is actually what God is thrusting upon you, then you need to steward that.
Sometimes I'm like, people, so greatness might be thrust upon you for a season through no fault of your own. But you don't, not everybody's going to choose to hang on to that bandwagon and go with it. Some of them are going to say, I do not need the spotlight. And it doesn't mean they're not following Jesus faithfully. It just means that you can go on to your next hero now or whatever.
Yeah, I like that. Because I think you and I both know plenty of cases where somebody had a calling for a season and wouldn't let that go.
Yeah.
And that's often where problems come, where somebody's like, no, I'm going to stay in this position. I'm not going to retire. I'm not going to move on. I want to keep this power, if you will.
Mm-hmm.
And so, yeah, I hear that for sure. I think Saul would be another example of somebody who, in the Old Testament, and again, we're dealing with the Old Testament, so they're not perfect corollaries, but someone in the Old Testament who was called by God for some reason, and, you know, he's literally hiding out among the stuff, trying to, you know, escape the greatness that he's being called to. And then when he gets into the greatness, it just goes south so badly.
Yeah.
So, yeah, I think, not to beat a dead horse here, but I think for me personally, I've seen and probably been guilty myself of this sort of, like I said before, faux humility. Where it's like, oh, I'm nothing, you know, people shouldn't really pay much attention to what I'm saying. And, you know, no, nobody cares about little old me. And it's like, well, one, that's not necessarily true. And two, maybe you're just being lazy. Maybe you don't want to have to watch carefully how you walk, because that's work. And I feel like Gideon, at least for me, from my takeaway, Gideon is kind of an example of somebody who was given something awesome from God, did some really great things, and then just kind of shrugged his shoulders and said, whatever.
Yeah. I get that.
So next week, we will have a rather spicy episode with Sheila Ray Gregoire. There's a lot of really good stuff there. But we'll leave you with the example of Gideon to reflect on. Let us know what you thought about the podcast. Let us know what you thought about Gideon and whether it's ever appropriate to step back from greatness being thrust upon you, and whether the word concubine really is an ugly word or not. Thanks for listening, and make sure you subscribe if you haven't yet. We will see you next time.
That Jesus Podcast is part of the Kingdom Outpost Podcast Network. For more articles, podcasts, and other resources, go to kingdomoutpost.org.